Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
This is John Paul.
And this is your X Tuesday episode for March, what is it, the 9th, I guess, when this will come out. And today we're talking about House of X number 5. Hopefully we're going to have two episodes for you today as well. We'll also talk about Powers of 10 number 5. And then next week do another couple, the last couple issues of these two series so we can start getting into the Dawn of X. I don't want to say torn. There's a part of me that's really excited to dive into everything Hickman's doing beyond these two setup series, because there are so many big ideas here, and this issue's no exception. I mean, this issue's in a way I keep saying this, like, this is the issue everything was leading up to. You know, we said that when the X-Men sacrificed themselves to take out the Mother Mold, or when we found out, hey, here's the way Krakoa is going to be set up and that kind of thing. And it's just, they're all foundational. Almost all these issues of House of X and Powers of 10 are foundational and really setting up everything that's going forward. The part of me that feels like maybe I'm not so excited is the part where just the way everything is set up, where Hickman kind of has his fingers in everything. And in order to get the full scope, you do have to read everything. We've talked about it before. You know, you got to read Excalibur, you got to read Marauders, you got to read X-Men, you got to read X-Factor, you got to read X-Force. It would be nice if they were a little more compartmentalized, but I get why he's doing it the way that he is. So again, I'm torn a little bit, but also, you know, being that I'm so far behind and we're just covering these now, I also see the seeds being planted for things like X-Factor and things like Ten of Swords. So we'll get there eventually. And I'm curious, we may start to go even a little faster in terms of coverage. So I guess we'll have to just wait and see how our schedules allow us to do that. So, but I wanted to ask you, John Paul, before we dive into the issue itself, do you remember back when you first read this, what your reaction was? Because I went and actually read a review after I read this in preparation for this recording. And they said in the review that, and this review was written right after this issue came out, they said in the review that what happens in the issue wasn't necessarily a surprise to them, but, you know, they had kind of expected it, but it still was done so well that it was, you know, they loved it and it was very interesting. And they also mentioned that the death of those X-Men that we saw a couple of issues previous, of, you know, all the ones that we talked about, Nightcrawler and Wolverine and Cyclops and all the, they said those deaths weren't really a surprise either, that it was kind of expected. And thus what happened is this issue was expected. So, you know, being that you read this as it was coming out, we'll turn to you for your perspective again. What were your thoughts right after reading this, and was it expected by you?
I don't know if I would say expected, but it wasn't a complete surprise, because even in House of X 1, there was foreshadowing. You saw, some of these same scenes, but just pieces of them, so you didn't know exactly what was going on. Of course, I knew that those characters weren't dead. I didn't know exactly how they come back, but I don't know how to describe it. It was semi-expected, but a little surprising. I don't really don't know how to describe it that well.
Yeah, so maybe not expected, but not a shock either.
No, it wasn't a huge shock.
Yeah.
I mean, the characters, as we'll get into, used for this process were a kind of a shock, but other than that, no.
All right, well, let's dive into the issue. It starts off, we have Apocalypse on the cover, and he's walking through some swampland on Krakoa, I guess. It's an interesting image and plays into the kind of the last page of the book. So we'll get to that when we get there. The quote on the first page, do you want to know the real difference between them and us? Them obviously being humans and us being mutants. Until now, we were never given a chance. What exactly he means by never given a chance? I mean, is mutants have never caught a break? I guess you can't argue with that. So, but I'm not sure I really know what the reason for that quote is. So it starts off, we see an aerial view of Krakoa, and Polaris is talking to Magneto, and she says, humans, is there any good in them? And Magneto goes on a little speech here. He says, well, it's important to remember that mankind didn't even take off as a species until they put down some roots. You know, they stopped with the hunting and gathering and became more of an agricultural-like society. They stopped and said, hey, this is a good place with fertile ground, and they planted things. And they said, we will not be moved from this land. This land is ours. So, you know, clearly he is kind of looking at this and saying, now it's time for mutants to do the same. It's time for mutants to put down some roots and say that, you know, this land is our land and we will not be moved. And you know, that's sort of the whole point of Krakoa. You know, they have a place to call their own. But what I do find interesting, his follow-up to that is, you know, it's the one good thing humans taught us, which is society. And when you look at that, so often I think about where we are as a society now, right? And how humans coming together has caused so many problems. You know, now we have a global society. It's not, you know, this society over here and this society over there based on population and a lack of technology to travel and this and that. And, you know, it seems like the smaller the world becomes in terms of communication, the more divisive things are, and there's more wars and, you know, there's greater population. So it's fighting over resources and all that kind of thing. So when you think about humans and society, I just wonder if we wouldn't have been better off in the old way. You know, like think back to the Native Americans where they lived, they had societies and they had culture. And, you know, much, you know, smaller forms of society in terms of tribes. And not that they didn't have tribal warfare, but it was, you know, much more rare. And you didn't have things like, you know, systemic racism and, you know, all the kind of stuff that goes along with that. And they were, you didn't have pollution. and I get it, like the world is a different place. But my point being that back then, living in that simpler time, society, you could think of the societies we have now as being a negative, right? Like humanity has followed a path where society is actually a bad thing. And it's actually the opposite for mutants here. So I do find that interesting, that Magneto would say, yeah, it's the one good thing that humans have given us. It's society. So I find that to be really, really interesting, especially if you go back and think about it in terms of what's in the Bible. You know, Adam and Eve, Garden of Eden, there was no society. It was just, hey, here's God gifting humans or mankind or whatever you want to put it with paradise. And then, you know, when they get thrown out, they're punished with, what is it, the pain of childbirth and having to, you know, raise your own food and not just living in a garden where the food just grows. So in a way, you could look at it as they're punished with having to create a society. So in that way, it's the same kind of thing. You know, society is associated with not good, right? If it wasn't for getting thrown out of the Garden of Eden and original sin, we wouldn't have to worry about society. And then Magneto's flipping it around, saying, no, society is actually good. And mutants finally have a society to build on and to have their own identity. So I just thought that was really, really interesting that he would say that. That's the one good thing humans taught us, society. So anyway, as they're having this conversation, we see that Charles and Storm come walking up, and Magneto continues and he says, you know, Charles and I had always wondered what would happen if mutants rather stopped being hunted by humans, if we didn't have to run, if we didn't have to hide, you know, what would it be like? Would we be able to establish a mutant kingdom? And the greatest traits to establish that kingdom didn't have to be strength or aggressiveness, right? So you could defend yourself from these humans that are still hunting mutants. Instead, you could focus on ingenuity and creativity and intelligence and, you know, all the things that sort of come with a protected society. Because when you're busy waging war and struggling to survive, you can't really really focus on making things that are beautiful or creating new inventions. All your energy goes into just surviving day to day. So that's kind of what they have with Krakoa, even though at this point they haven't been recognized as their own sovereign nation yet. That'll come later. But at least they've established something that's theirs, where they can go and they can be safe and they're not being hunted, and they can start thinking about building new things. Like we saw in the last issue we covered, Powers of 10, number 4, where Doug Ramsey, Cypher, goes in and starts creating all these systems that they can use in symbiosis with Krakoa to travel around the world through biological gates and invite other mutants to come and have a universal language that all mutants understand and things like that, because they're not spending all their energy just trying to survive. So once Charles and Storm join them, Polaris says, okay, here they come. And we see the five. We're introduced to the five for the first time. And these aren't new mutants or original mutants, I should say. You know, these are mutants that we've seen before, but they all have a very special function. And it's really interesting to see what they do. And it's huge, huge, huge in terms of the ramifications for the Marvel Universe and for the mutants in general. So first we're told about Fabio Medina, and Magneto says he had kind of a pointless power before he could make golden balls appear. And until only recently, we knew that they were composed of biological matter and that there was no upper limit to the number of balls that he could create. So a couple of things here that I'll mention. First of all, I'll say that golden balls is the worst mutant name I've ever heard in my life. I mean,
it is real bad. It's real bad. Golden balls, right?
Right. It's so bad. Like, this guy's got, and I know, and because of his role he plays here, he is revered as one of the five or whatever. But oh my God, dude, this guy has got to be relentlessly teased because his name is like, how about the golden goose, you know, because he's laying golden eggs or creating golden eggs. Something better than gold. Something better than golden balls, you know. You know, golden balls, it sounds like the name of an Austin Powers villain.
that's what came to mind when I first heard the name.
Oh man, so bad. So anyway, but the fact of the matter is they didn't know what they could use these golden balls for. They were composed of biological matter. But one thing that's interesting I want to point out is that technically golden balls, I can't even say that with a straight face. Technically golden balls is an omega level mutant, right? Because whoever has the ability to manifest a certain power, no matter what that might be, without limits, they're considered omega level, right? Like Storm is the omega level mutant that can, you know, control weather. She has no upper limits. And Doug Ramsey's the omega level polyglot and what have you. So this guy technically is the omega level golden egg guy, I guess. There's no limit. So I did find that interesting, because you hear about other omega level, like Iceman's the omega level ice guy. There's other mutants with ice based powers, but they don't have the intensity or the strength to manifest ice and control cold the way Iceman does, right? When it comes to cold, he's the guy. He's the most powerful one. So I just find that. Yeah, exactly. And so I find it interesting that this guy, so could there possibly be other guys that lay other sorts of eggs or golden eggs or whatever, but he's always going to be the guy. He's always going to be golden balls, as it were. So just, based on the fact that they discovered these balls contained biological material, they actually discovered they were eggs, right? So the next step would be with a touch by Proteus, who's actually Moira McTaggart's son, one of her sons. He has the ability to warp reality, and we've seen that throughout, from his entire history from when he first showed up back in the classic Claremont Byrne era. So he would touch these eggs and warp reality, and those eggs would become viable. They would be, ready for fertilization, for lack of a better term. So then what they would do, the next step would be to inject those eggs with some preserved DNA of a mutant, which we did see in the last issue we covered. where Professor X and Magneto had made the deal with Mr. Sinister to have that codex of DNA, to have that library of mutant DNA, so they always have a reference for any mutant who has died. The next step is another of these mutants, Elixir, who his mutant power is the ability to kickstart life, basically. He's a life giver. He can kickstart the process of cellular replication. So you've got this biological egg that has, you know, biological matter, you know, a bunch of building blocks, you know, carbon atoms and whatnot that, you know, human bodies, physical bodies are actually made of. Then you inject some DNA of a mutant in there, and then Elixir basically kickstarts this, where these cells that have now been had this mutant DNA introduced into it then start replicating. So after that, all the mutant embryo needs is time to mature. So whosever DNA you injected it with, you basically have just made a clone. I mean, what they're describing here, obviously without the golden eggs or whatever, but the idea of injecting biological matter with certain DNA, that's how they cloned Dolly the sheep, right? They took DNA from another sheep, they injected it into the biological material, and then the embryo started to grow of that sheep. So in order for it not to take the normal time it would take, like, you know, we'll just take Cyclops, for example. He's the first one we see come back. But in order for Cyclops to come out as Cyclops, come out of this egg as Cyclops, you know, he's whatever, mid-30s. You can't wait 30 years. But another one of these five mutants is Eva Bell, and she has the ability to manipulate time. So she can make time pass faster inside the egg so that the embryo matures and grows to whatever age they want it to at a much faster rate. So Magneto does say, you know, creating life is very delicate. It's almost impossible. And none of these mutants would be able to handle this on their own. But the last of the five is Hope Summers. She's the great unifier. You know, she can copy other mutants' powers, but she also has the ability to make sure everybody else is operating at sort of peak efficiency and working synergistically together really well in unison. And so separate, they're great mutants and they're significant, but they're not transcendent. But when you put them all together, the way Magneto puts it, you put all five of these mutants together and they've made us whole, because they've basically made mutants immortal. And to John Paul's point earlier, we then see, and this goes back to a scene we saw in House of X number one, we see these golden balls or these eggs hatch, and we see that one of them is Cyclops, one of them is Jean Grey, and we see Professor X there greeting them. It's pretty much the exact same page we saw in issue one, with Cyclops waking up and Professor X saying, "To me, my X-Men." And so how is this possible, right? Like, yes, I understand the physical aspect of it. You can regrow the body. It'll be basically a clone. But how is it actually Cyclops? And you would think that Polaris would kind of know this stuff, but I guess she's our POV character because she's trying to understand it too. And she's asking Magneto the questions about how it works. And she says, "Okay, I get it, Father, but isn't it just bodies, right? They've been temporarily, you know, time aged up artificially to the desired age. And yeah, supposedly they're in their perfect form because they've just grown to their current age in this egg without ever having battle or scars," which is an interesting point that we'll get to about Cyclops in a second. But Lorna says, "But it's not them, right? Like, it's just a shell. They don't have their mind. They don't have their personality, because they don't have their life experiences, because they just grew up to whatever age they are inside the shell." And Magneto says, "Watch." And this is another thing that's kind of a retcon that I don't know that I have a problem with, but it's something interesting to talk about. And he says, "All this time, everybody's misunderstood what Cerebro was. Like, we just thought it was this mutant detector and Charles could locate any mutant in the world. But that was actually the secondary function of the machine. The first was when it found a mutant mind, it copied that mutant mind, right? The essence, the anima of any mutant that Xavier found. So one day he could put the soul back inside its mutant shell." So supposedly, Cerebro has a copy of every mutant's personality and mind and their essence, their brain patterns, like all that kind of stuff. It makes Xavier, who controls Cerebro, even more powerful and potentially more dangerous. And also the fact that you're copying these people's essence, you're copying their mind without their consent. So what about privacy? What about consent? What about if this falls into the hands of the wrong people? So, I mean, it kind of goes back into the idea that, you know, Xavier is not this great savior and really good guy that he always pretends to be. I mean, I think people should have a say in whether or not their personality, their mind, their essence, who they are, their soul, if you want to take it to that level, the way Magneto puts it. Xavier's got a big, you know, storage thing in the cloud that stores everybody's soul. Like, I don't know that I feel okay about that. What do you think?
Well, no, it's not okay. I mean, you think about our privacy laws nowadays and how in uproar people were that Facebook was taking information that they didn't, you know, consent to. This is a big step above. So
yeah. I mean, 100%. And I didn't even think about it in terms of that. Yeah, but I mean, if you have somebody's mind copied, you know all their deepest, darkest secrets. You know their bank information, you know their social security number. You know this is, it's kind of interesting to think about that way. The other thing that I want to mention, I talked about these bodies being aged up, and you know Lorna even says, yeah, they're kind of perfect specimens, right? Optimal and perfected forms. So when you talk about Cyclops, his mutant power being the ability to project these force beams from his eyes, right? But if we go back to his origins, I think this is still the case. It hasn't been changed to my knowledge. The reason that he can't control them on his own, the way Havoc, his brother, who, you know, uses the same kind of cosmic energy and can project, you know, force bolts from his hands or his body, but he can control it. He can control when it's released. The reason Cyclops can't control the optic beams that come from his eyes is because of that accident they had when they jumped out of the plane and he hit his head. And he had, you know, some minor brain damage, and that doesn't allow him to control when his eye beams go off. So he has to wear the visor or the ruby quartz glasses, right? Like, that's still a thing, right, John Paul? Am I right to think of that? Okay, so if you're taking his DNA and you're growing a new one, wouldn't that brain damage not have happened?
Yep.
So why does he still have to wear the visor and glasses?
Because he thinks he has to.
So it's all in his mind, huh? Okay, I can buy that. Psychosomatic.
That's my explanation.
Yeah. I mean, it does make sense. Yeah, he can't control him because he thinks he can't control him because that's how it's always been. Yeah. I mean, I guess when you think about it, it does make sense. If you're laying down his brain waves and his way of thinking, even though the damage isn't there, his way of thinking, he basically, he's not aware the damage isn't there. So his body's tricked into thinking that the damage is there. His brain is,
you know, there is one copy of one mutant that I still have trouble with. Like, where do you get the adamantium from? That doesn't come naturally.
I suppose it depends on just, I mean, they say it's biological material inside the golden balls. Right. At what level does it break down, right? Because if you think about it, everything's made out of atoms. And if you just rearrange the atoms of whatever you have, you could technically recreate adamantium just by putting the atoms into the correct framework to become molecules and the molecules in the correct framework to make the element adamantium. But that's not biological material, so I guess I do see your point.
That's the only one I'm like, that one's hard to get over for me.
I could see your point with Cyclops. So it could be that even though that part of his brain is not damaged because the way his copy is you know, the copy of his brain waves and personality and experience, everything doesn't use that part of his brain in his original body because it was damaged. So when you put the copy in, even though that part's no longer damaged, his brain is not wired to use that brain damaged part, even though it's not damaged anymore. But it would be interesting to explore whether he could learn to use it, learn to, you know, use that part of his brain that allows him to control his optic blasts, and then he wouldn't have to wear the visor. So I don't know that I would
look as cool. Yeah, he wouldn't look as cool without the visor. That's part of his appeal, right? I mean, I think so.
I always thought the visor looked kind of dumb, to be honest with you.
Really?
I do like visor. Well, so he's taken to wearing the silverish visor, and I do like the silver visor better. But
than the yellow one?
Yeah, than the yellow or goldish one. Yeah. So anyway, I'd have no problem with him using the visor to help regulate if it's a tight beam or a wide beam or whatever when he's in custom, but at least let the guy not have to wear those red ruby quartz glasses when he's not in costume, you know?
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, like at least
I wonder what his eyes would look like when they're open though, you know, if he had full control over it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would they look like Gambit?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the only time I've seen him not wear the glasses is when I think it was in the was it in the Phoenix Resurrection, or when he saw Jean and she used her powers to hold the beams in.
So I think I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, poor Cyclops, even though this is an optimized body, he still has to wear the visor. But yeah, it's a great point about the adamantium. I wonder, I'm going to have to do a little research online and see if anybody has talked about that. It definitely would be a question for Hickman if we ever had him on. So anyway, getting back to what's happening in the issue, as Cyclops is laying there and Professor X has put the visor on, says, "Oh, there you are, my boy. Even knowing I could bring you back, part of me dies when you do. Let's not do that again." So, I mean, at least they're still acknowledging there is some repercussions. You know, it is physically painful to die, you know, depending on how you die. And just because everybody can come back doesn't mean that they're just going to be out there sacrificing themselves willy-nilly. I don't think that it lessens the sacrifice either, because nothing is foolproof. Nothing is perfect. And each time you die, there's a possibility maybe you couldn't come back. But it does open up a whole big can of worms in terms of, man, can these mutants now live forever? And you want to talk about a planet being populated with only mutants. At some point, if these mutants, you know, continue to procreate and none of them ever die, at some point you got to think, well, you're going to run out of resources. So as Cyclops wakes up, he asks, "Did it work?" And Xavier says, "Yes, your sacrifice was not in vain. You saved us all. Thank you, Scott. Thank you all." And we see the rest of the mutants that went on the mission to stop the mother mold from coming online, all resurrected as well. Next we see, and this is kind of weird to me, but Storm is there and she's telling all the other mutants on Krakoa to get on your feet. The world's not ready for the likes of your return, but Krakoa is waiting. And then we get the title page written by Jonathan Hickman, Pepe Larraz as artist, Marte Garcia on colors, and Clayton Cowell on letters. Brothers and sisters of Krakoa, Storm says, and she introduces all the mutants that have come back. But first she says, "A great thing has happened today, a miracle made possible by mutant hands, the great work of the five. And these five, even Golden Balls, are all sort of revered. But I got to think, once Golden Balls walks away from a certain area, they all just kind of laugh and say, Golden Balls, whatever." But Storm, as her purpose, you know, as sort of this figurehead, queen, regal type person, talks about how these five have righted the wrongs of man and defeated the great enemy, death. And we see outcome the mutants that died destroying Mother Mold. I do find it a little creepy that they all come walking out naked. I guess just to prove that they are who they are and they're like an actual physical body. And although I suppose they could be some sort of cyborg. But anyway, she says, "By the power that is their birthright, the five have returned these back to us that we had lost. This is their family. This is their place. This is their home. I see them. Do you?" And everybody chants, "Yes, we see them. But do we know them?" So this is clearly a ritual. Like, these are I don't want to say programmed responses, but responses they're supposed to give. You know, it's all scripted. And Storm then asks, "What is your name?" Cyclops says, "Cyclops, Scott Summers. How do I know it's you, brother?" And he gives an example of something he, you know, a conversation he had with Storm that only she would know. And then she calls out, "This is my brother. I know him. As do you. His name is Cyclops, but he's more than that. What is he?" And they all chant or cheer, "Mutant," and so on and so forth for all the mutants that have returned. Jean Grey and Monet St. Croix and Wolverine and you know, the whole thing. And I don't know, man, this is just really, really creepy to me. Like, it's one thing to have a society and have some rituals or sort of traditions that kind of bring you all together. But this is a little cult-like for me. You know, they're standing up there naked. It's all scripted responses. And I don't know, wouldn't you just, like, I get wanting to make sure that the right soul, for lack of a better term, is downloaded and put in the right body. So you do want to ask, hey, who are you? Who do you think you are? Whatnot. But what's to keep somebody who has, you know, taken over Cyclops's body, has set things up to, I don't know, I'm trying to think of somebody like a Doctor Doom-like person in Cyclops's body, you know, him downloaded in there instead of Cyclops, Scott Summers' personality or whatnot, from lying and saying, yeah, I'm Scott Summers. I mean, wouldn't you just have like somebody who's got psychic powers just do a quick scan and make sure they are who they say they are? Or Professor X himself? Hey, yes, this is who he says he is, instead of going through this kind of creepy ritual. I don't know. It came across as really weird and cult-like to me. What did you think, John Paul?
Well, okay. Minor spoilers for what goes on forward in the X-Line. I haven't seen this ritual repeated in the same fashion since. So I think this particular ritual is because it was the first successful time that the five were able to bring mutants back.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. I could buy that. So anyway, to continue on, Professor X and Magneto are watching kind of from the sidelines. And Magneto says, man, I should be watching this and be happy and be filled with joy. But obviously he's not. And Professor X says, I know. And I think it's because over the years, man has killed so many of us. There's so many that need to come back. There's so many of us that remain lost. But, you know, got to acknowledge that this is good work, like bringing these people back. And Magneto says, yeah, and it must continue. Genosha is spoken of not as a grave, but as a crucible. And Professor X says, yes, this work will continue until it's done. It is foundational, everything. And Magneto, you know, ever the militant, got to throw this in there. They should have killed us all when they had the chance. So basically what we're coming to learn here is Professor X is saying all those mutants that died, all those millions of mutants that John Paul and I talked about a few episodes ago, in terms of, you know, Genosha and other sort of other aspects, other mutant catastrophes that have happened, they're planning on bringing all of them back. So again, I go back to wondering, how is Krakoa going to be big enough for all these people? We're talking almost 20 million people. And how long do you, I mean, is that 20 million immortals? Like, there's a lot of questions to be asked. What about the mutants that lost their powers during House of M? Like, when they are cloned or brought back or hatched from the golden balls or whatever you want to say, do they have their powers or do they not have their powers? Like, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. So Professor X then is asked by Magneto, hey, when does the UN vote? And Professor X says, tomorrow, Security Council meets in the morning, and this is the vote to decide if the United Nations is going to recognize Krakoa as its own sovereign nation. And Magneto asks if he's worried, and Professor X says, well, not today. Today I'm filled with nothing but hope, and we get another glimpse of the ritual continuing with them all chanting. So as we move on, we get a couple of the text pages here, and they explain a little more in detail about the resurrection, how these guys come back. So it talks about the genetic base and how Mr. Sinister had this repository of mutant genetic material, and it was actual physical samples at one point, but then they did convert it to like a holographic representation. there's a little note there. It talks about the host, which is, you know, in the process of mutant resurrection, genetic base is introduced to the organic material that is in that that egg, and then that allows the you know, the body to basically grow. And then it goes over the five mutants again and tells what their contribution is, which, you know, we already went over. And then it talks about the resurrection itself, talks about the Proteus problem, because we have seen in the past, we know Proteus, his mutant power kind of consumes the body that he lives in. And so based on how often he uses his power, his body has to be replaced. So normally, under normal kind of usage of his powers, his body will last 1 week, but it can last as little as 1 day if he's using his powers a lot. So Proteus always has a backup mutant husk being created. they're constantly growing themselves a new Proteus, and that husk is created with the genetic base of Charles Xavier, who's his dad, so that kind of makes sense. But you do kind of worry about always having these clones of Charles being created, just because he's such a powerful mutant. Then they talk about the mind, which is the backup, where Charles Xavier takes the latest backup. We're told there's that Charles copies the latest version, in quotes, of every mutant mind once a week, and they're stored in cradles located across several locations across the world as backups in case one cradle gets destroyed. There's another one somewhere else, and it's the essence of each of these mutants, how they think, how they feel, their memories, their very being. And Charles then injects the backup of who they are into the husk as the mutant is being reborn, which means if you start trying to resurrect a lot of mutants, like, I don't know physically how Charles does that. You know, he's got to be present. You need somebody else to have the ability to do it. And also, there's a note here too that does say, there's been no experimentation regarding what happens if you try to combine a mutant mind with a husk that's not their own. Like, how would that work? Then we do talk about scale, which I just mentioned. So supposedly right now they can raise about 1,000 mutants a week, or about 200 a day. Current estimated population of mutants on Earth is around 100,000, like we talked about before. The depowered population of mutants is just under 1 million. And then you've got another 16 million from Genosha who are deceased. So, you know, how do you get all of them back? At the rate of 1,000 a day, it would take about 300 years to bring everybody back, let alone how to address the depowered mutants and any that might die in the interim time period, or any mutant villains that have died, you know, that were just bad people. Do you really want to bring them back? And then we're told the resurrection machine, as it's working now, is getting better and better at what it does, becoming more efficient, and the capabilities could grow to maybe as much as 30,000 a week. And if you're talking about restoring or bringing back to life the full population of Genosha, it could be done in about 10 years. The complication here is that Xavier, and this is what I was just talking about, Xavier would have to download or resurrect 6,000 minds a day, which he's not capable of. But by that time, there may be a workaround or a team of telepaths who are trained to use Cerebro properly, because, like, it's just physically not possible for him to, you know, put in the memories or resurrect the minds of 6,000 mutants a day. And that does bring back a question about the whole retrocon of what Cerebro has been doing. So all along, and it's never been mentioned, and I always have a problem when you do something that big. If it was that big, it would have been mentioned at some point before. Obviously, it wasn't mentioned because no writer had thought of it, but it like doesn't make sense. But at the same time, you know, comics, so whatever. And we do get a couple notes here talking about how the five, they're not operating under duress or fatigue. It's not really hard for them to do what they do. And in fact, they become stronger, and it's becoming more easier to resurrect people and to be part of this process the more times they do it. And the experience does fill them with bliss, not in a addictive sort of way, but just they feel total fulfillment is the way that Hickman puts it, basically, for, you know, bringing somebody back to life. And the five have appeared to become an inseparable family unit. They spend a lot of their time together. And some of it could be psychological, or on Krakoa, they're all kind of revered as being these, you know, incredibly important part of mutant culture now. And so maybe that's part of the shared experience they all have, where they basically hang out together. Then we talk about the resurrection protocol. It takes around 48 hours for the husk to grow into the body. And because of fears regarding duplication, because obviously you wouldn't want to bring somebody back who's not dead, they always wait until somebody has been gone, believed to be dead, and they've been undetectable by Cerebro for a month before they'll bring anybody back. It is expected sooner or later that a mutant organization will be tasked with investigating mutant missing persons or mutants that are suspected to have been killed so they can confirm that the person's been killed, that they're no longer there, and they can start the resurrection process. That's the whole idea of X Factor. That's the X Factor title that's written by Leah Williams. So we're already getting hints of it here, even though it didn't come out for, I think, over a year after this issue. It's also expected that should force conventions become necessary, their extra special mandate would supersede normal resurrection protocols. So basically, if you have certain mutants that are really good at fighting and you need them, then they would skip the line, as it were, and you might try to resurrect them a little bit quicker. So, you know, as I've said in the past, you don't necessarily have to read the text pages, but these are pretty important text pages. It really lays out sort of the fact that mutants have become immortal. And that's a big deal, both in terms of sort of the just the makeup of the Marvel Universe, the fact that you can't kill a mutant, they just keep coming back. But also it does raise ethical questions. Like, what if somebody doesn't want to be brought back? What if something goes wrong? How can you be sure it's still the same person? Is it technically still the same person? It's not the same matter. And then the whole idea of there being a mistake and there being two people and who has a right. Now, what, you know, you want to get into the whole argument of when life begins and when it doesn't. Like, there's a lot of moral implications that Hickman is just sweeping under the rug here. So this idea that mutants are immortal is a cool idea that they can resurrect people, but it does make me, there's a part of me, the philosophical part of me, and I know this is all fake stuff, right? But there is a part of me that thinks, okay, if this was real, there are some real ethical problems in my mind with what they're doing. They're basically playing God, creating life. And I just don't trust anybody, human, mutant, or otherwise, with this much power. The power to create and manipulate life, it leaves me very uneasy. I don't know. How do you feel about it, John Paul?
Well, it's like you said, if this were real, I'd have a huge problem with it too. I'd probably want to be ignorant about it, to be honest. It's like, yeah. I don't want to know about this. It's like, because if I did, I would be constantly troubled and a little bit afraid, you know, because these are superpowered beings. And some of them are not good. And should they be brought back if they were to die, you know? So, but all that being said, it is fictional. So, and it makes for a good story. So I have no problem with it.
Yeah, I agree with you. And part of it harkens back to the conversation I don't know if you heard the episode, John Paul, but the conversation I had with Ryan Parrott about his Aftershock series, Dead Day, where people come back from the dead, and talking about how much society would change because you do have certain people and certain behaviors that aren't done. People don't do certain things, or certain behaviors that just, you know, they're not accepted, it's not acceptable, and people don't do them because of the inherent risk. Like, if I do this, I might die. If I go on a shooting spree at a grocery store, and the police come and shoot me, I'm dead. And so there may be certain people that don't engage in certain behaviors because of the inherent fragility of, you know, the human body and life. You know, you could be killed. If you remove the consequences for some of these behaviors, especially for some of these villains, hey, I can go blow myself up and, you know, suicide bomber my way, you know, across the country or what have you, and keep getting resurrected. You know, like, there's a certain part of the idea that, hey, death is the end. Death is a consequence. Death is a risk. And when you remove that risk, yeah, you're talking about fundamentally changing the way society looks at things and the way people behave. So yeah, it's definitely, I mean, thank God it's just mutants here. And supposedly, Xavier's got, and he's a good guy and he's got a handle on it and he's got to be involved in putting the psyche back or anything. But yeah, it's a big can of worms. So anyway, as we turn the page, next day, United Nations, and it's time for the vote of whether the United Nations will recognize Krakoa as a sovereign nation. And we see that Professor Xavier is there, Beast is there, and White Queen is there. And telepathically, White Queen and Xavier are having a conversation. And White Queen's saying, "You're loving this." And he's like, "Well, what's not to," or actually, Xavier's saying to White Queen, "You're loving this, aren't you?" And she's saying, "Well, what's not to love? Congratulations, you won yourself a nation." So it's clear that the United Nations sided with Krakoa and with the mutants, saying, "Yes, we recognize you as a sovereign nation." What I do find weird is, although Charles is in a suit, he's still wearing the giant fishbowl helmet, which just looks weird to me. And he's not in a wheelchair, I guess, because to our point about his body being regrown, maybe his body's been regrown and it's now optimal and not damaged. Not even in his own mind did he think that he can't use his legs. And we saw that before. There was a time when Professor X's body was cloned and he could once again walk for a short time before he was injured again. Bad luck when it comes to that, I suppose. But anyway, he tells Frost, "It's our nation, due, I suspect, in no small measure to you." And come to find out, Professor Xavier sensed that the White Queen was using her telepathic abilities to kind of influence the vote. And not so much that she forced somebody to vote their way, but Professor Xavier knew for sure the French ambassador had told him that the Russian ambassador was going to be voting against them being a nation. And all of a sudden, she decided to abstain at the last moment. And White Queen tries to play it off like, "Oh, well, maybe she changed her mind. Who knows? Maybe she had a crisis of conscience." And Xavier says, "Compelling somebody to do something leaves a mark on the victim, and it also affects the one perpetrating the act. Dominating the will of another, it comes with a cost." And White Queen says, "Are you accusing me of something?" So starts to get defensive. And Xavier's like, "I just wanted you to know that I knew what you had done, and I'm grateful for your sacrifice because you've taken a risk. Somebody will always be able to, anybody who can go and read her mind will always be able to tell that she had done that." And White Queen says, "Oh, you're welcome. Why don't you buy me something pretty or make me the governor of a province or something?" And Xavier says, "First of all, what could I possibly buy you that you don't have? You have everything. And as to your second request, I already have bolder things in mind for you." So what that might be, who knows? We know that White Queen has not always been on the side of the angels for sure. So we do get another text page here, and it basically just talks about the current situation of mutant diplomacy in this world that Hickman's created. Most of the nations of the world have a trade agreement with the mutants to get that medication that we talked about previously, I think way back in issue one of House of X. So more than 100 nations have accepted that trade deal, and there's negotiations ongoing with most of the rest of the nations, but there are some that have rejected the Krakoan overtures, and they don't see Krakoa as a nation, although they don't really have a choice at this point because enough of the United Nations recognize them that they are their own nation. And we get a list of these nations that do not agree, and their reason for rejection is either political, ideological, or in some cases, they just don't need the medicine. So in Asia, it's Iran, Madripoor, and North Korea that oppose, with Iran and North Korea ideologically opposed to the idea of a mutant nation, and Madripoor politically opposed. In Europe, Latveria, rather, Dr. Doom's nation, and Russia are politically opposed to the nation. In South America, Brazil and Venezuela are politically opposed, and Santo Marco and Terra Verde are ideologically opposed. In Central America, Honduras is politically opposed. And then in Africa, we've got Wakanda. They're so far advanced, they don't need the mutant drugs. And then Aznia, Canaan, and Kenya are all part of the Wakandan Economic Protectorate, so they also don't need the mutant drugs. So it's pretty interesting. The one that stands out to me on the list is Brazil. They are very much like the United States in terms of a very diverse population, in terms of race and all that kind of stuff. And so the idea that they're politically opposed, I find to be the most interesting, how Hickman thinks that dovetails with real world stuff. Most of the others, it kind of makes sense, but Brazil's the one I'd be like, why would Brazil be opposed? So anyway, we do get a map on the next page that shows which areas those countries are in that are opposed. I don't really see a particular need for a map, but whatever, it's there anyway. So 2 days later, after Krakoa has been recognized as a mutant nation, the invite has gone out to mutants all around the world. Hey, this is your safe place. This is where you can come and be a part of something. And Wolverine is standing there at one of the biological gates, and he's asking Professor X and Magneto, are you sure about this? It's not too late to change your mind. Professor X says, this opportunity to change is exactly what they're offering. Come and be a part of the mutant nation, whether you were a hero before or a villain or whatever. Come be part of the nation, be part of something bigger than yourself. And X-Men, Wolverine rather, says, Chuck, I got to tell you, when you talk like that, I kind of want to beat you to death. Some people are beyond saving. So I don't know. Wolverine, ever the curmudgeon, I guess you'd say. And Magneto does have an interesting point here. He says, well, if that were true, if some people were beyond saving, then I wouldn't be here, would I? So then they get Professor X gets a message. Hey, there are so many incoming, 20 in the first wave, too many to count following that. And Cypher says, okay, Sage, we'll just ask Krakoa to turn the throttle off and keep the gates open, and everybody will come walking through. So here we go. All the mutants start showing up. And we're seeing what they show us is a lot of villains, because that's, you know, the big thing, right? Like we see the version of Mr. Sinister that has the X gene. We see Random. We see Wildside. We see Sebastian Shaw, which is really interesting to me. Really, like, he's going to give up his position as the Black King of the Hellfire Club to come be part of this nation. Like, is he going to think he can, have a power base here? He always seemed like somebody who was overly ambitious to me. So he surprises me that he would be in the first wave. We do see Callisto also, and I imagine her Morlocks come too. This seems like they would be the first ones through, like, right? They've always been looking for a place to belong, and living in the sewers of New York is not pleasant. So, of course, they jump at the chance. And then at the bottom of the page, we see maybe the most surprising and the one that has perhaps the most ramifications to do harm. And that's Apocalypse. He comes walking through and he says, ah, Krakoa, it's been too long. And we obviously know, we saw little hints before about Krakoa's origin, that Apocalypse had something to do with that. And if you've read Ten of Swords, you know the way he's all tied in. So it is interesting. Krakoa basically greets him with a flock of doves, which is symbolic, I suppose, in terms of here's this guy who was the first mutant, and this sort of flock of doves configuration, the way it flies around them. It's very indicative of a lot of old school paintings in the Renaissance of depictions of heaven. So Krakoa clearly has love for Apocalypse. And when Wolverine sees this, maybe he's a little jealous or put off by it. He goes, ah, you're making yourself a little comfortable, aren't you, pal? And Apocalypse's response is interesting. Comfortable is an inadequate word, right? I am comfortable because Krakoa knows me and I know Krakoa. So he definitely feels at home, like he's greeting an old friend. And he mentions, it's here that I fought the war before the world even knew there was such a thing as mutants. And Magneto says, well, that's fitting because we fought for something as well, right? That being the nation of Krakoa, the nation for mutants themselves. And we've gained it. And we want to be here, clear, Apocalypse. We're not going to risk losing this place because of something that you do, right? Because you don't value what it is we've gained. And Wolverine kind of growls at him. Yeah, is that going to be a problem? And again, Apocalypse with a very philosophical and interesting answer. He's like, well, why would it be a problem? For centuries, I've been fostering war and conflict in the hopes that mutants would finally assert their dominance over the world, right? Would show that we are better, we are superior. And now look at you, he says. Now look at all of you. They're not necessarily dominating. And Apocalypse technically doesn't say that. He does, well, I guess he does in a way, because he says asserting dominance over the world. And they're not to that point yet. They're not asserting dominance, but they're certainly showing that they have the potential for dominance. Not that I think that they've made it public knowledge that, hey, we have our own resurrection cycle here and we're all immortal. Clearly, I don't think Professor X and the rest of the mutants would want the world to know that. But they're definitely much further down the path of ruling the world than they've ever been before. And maybe that's what Apocalypse is recognizing. So he says, you finally become what I intended you to be. I could not be more proud. And Magneto's like, we need to hear the words. That's not enough. And so Apocalypse gives him what he wants. It says, we submit to the laws of this land, be what they may, and acknowledge from this day forward, we all serve a higher purpose than want or need. So it's not about the individual want or the individual need. It's serving that higher purpose of making sure that the mutant nation survives. And Apocalypse says, one people from this day forward. And Professor X responds, very well, let it be known, let the word be spread. Krakoa is for all mutants. And he reaches out and shakes Apocalypse's hand and says, welcome home. And that's how the issue ends, with the last quote from Magneto saying, if you are us, then be with us, come home. Obviously strength in numbers with the all the mutants together, one nation all living on Krakoa. So a really important issue. A lot of ramifications, obviously Krakoa being recognized as its own nation, them setting up themselves as a world power is obviously huge. And then even more than that, the fact that we learned that mutants are basically immortal. And not only are mutants immortal, even with beyond any kind of, you know, population growth from relationships that develop and them procreating, you're talking about raising 17 million mutants from the dead to grow your population that way at a steady rate. I mean, again, you got to think the rest of the world, you almost can't blame them for being nervous, especially considering Krakoa is for all mutants, including all the villain, you know, the villainous mutants over the years who've caused mayhem and death and destruction. So a lot of ramifications. Some of it Hickman is setting us up to address. Some of the bigger ethical questions, I think he just kind of leaves as saying, like John Paul said, it is just fiction, so we can all sleep better at night because it's just a story, even though it's a good story. So don't think about it too much, I guess you'd say. So yeah, I thought it was a really well-crafted issue, very, very well-paced, and we get a big chunk of story and some really important developments in this one. What are your thoughts, Sean Paul?
Ooh, yeah, this is probably the basis for most things going forward. I'd say probably more than any other issue.
Yeah, and I think that when you start talking about the two parts of this, the immortality, which is huge, and then the fact that they're their own nation. And you can even kind of see, especially with Apocalypse showing up at the end, there's some inherent tension. You know, there's some inherent trust issues, you know, especially from Wolverine dealing with Apocalypse. Like, hey, can we really trust this guy? And he's really the one that you would worry the most about. He's been the most militant. He's been, you know, Magneto was always there, yes, and he was first, but in terms of publishing wise, obviously Apocalypse is supposed to be the first mutant, so he's been around a lot longer. We were introduced to Magneto first, and he was always sort of the prototypical villainous mutant who was fighting for mutant rights before we got to Apocalypse. But Apocalypse was, ever since he's come on the scene, it's been his sole overriding purpose. He's been unrelenting and you know, unwilling to compromise, and just steadfast in his belief that, you know, got to kill all the humans. And he even says it here, even though he's agreeing to stand down and to follow the laws of Krakoa, he says that it's always been his belief that mutants should be asserting their dominance. That hasn't changed. So you wonder what happens when that comes time, that what Magneto thinks or what Professor X thinks comes into conflict with what Apocalypse believes, and how much can Krakoa and Apocalypse being part of that society, how much can that influence and sort of temper Apocalypse and his sort of militaristic or antagonistic tendencies when it comes to humans? So a lot of stuff to unpack there. As far as the art goes, it's very consistent with the artwork that we've seen all along from Pepe Larraz. Really enjoy the color work that's done. Everything on Krakoa has a little bit of an interesting take in terms of color. A lot of greens and purples, which gives it that organic feel. Some pinks as well. A lot of like pastel colors, which gives it a softness, which works really, really well. And I gotta say, I don't know that Magneto's kind of white or silverish costume really does it for me. I sort of miss his old pink and purplish costume that he wore for so long. But no complaints about the art. It's solid throughout. Very good transitions from panel to panel. The issue's well paced, both from a narrative perspective and a visual perspective. So I think it hits all the right notes. And this issue does come across as being an extremely significant issue, like John Paul was saying. So anything else to add, John Paul, before we wrap up?
Well, I think that Jonathan Hickman going forward gives more character development to Apocalypse than any other writer. There's some interesting things going forward with Apocalypse, and that's all I'll say.
I look forward to that because I feel like Apocalypse has been sort of underdeveloped as a character. I feel like he's, for all his power and all his importance, he's been kind of a mustache twirling villain, very two-dimensional for the majority of time that he's existed, I feel like. And certainly he was much more on the side of Angels when we saw him in the X-Men Year 100 storyline, with the sacrifice he made to be sure Moira got the information she needed, and all that kind of thing. That does bring up an interesting point. We haven't seen Moira in present time on Krakoa. I wonder if there's any significance to that. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. So, all right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Hope you enjoyed it. We want to thank you for listening, as always, and we'll talk to you next time. You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.